Hey everybody, welcome again to F This Movie, the official podcast of FThisMovie.net, movie love for movie lovers. My name is Patrick Bromley, and I'm very excited for this week's show. We are kicking off summer 2017 in style. Here to talk Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2 is Mr. Eric Asperschlager. How are you, Eric?
I'm doing just fine, Patrick. How are you?
I am here. I'm excited that you're back to talk about this movie. Several years ago, you were on to talk about the first movie, which I think we both liked, right? I didn't have a chance to go back and listen to that one.
I think so. The only thing I remember about that is that I saw the movie, really liked it. I was up, you know, up wired after having seen it. It was late at night. I was on Google or Gmail, and I saw that Hollywood Heath Holland was on, and so we were chatted back and forth about the movie. We had this long conversation about it, and I feel like when I got to do the podcast with you, I kind of talked myself through the whole thing, and I feel like I kind of rambled a lot. So I have not talked to anyone about the movie this time.
Okay, good.
I'm not in my, shall we say, refractory podcasting period. I'm all set. I'm bursting. I'm ready to talk about this show.
We should have just released the transcript of you and
could have done that.
Right? Yeah, right.
Yeah. Good. I can pull it up right now if you'd like me to.
Ooh, that would be terrific. I'll read the part of you.
my Heath impression needs some work.
So we're going to be talking Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2. We'll talk spoiler-free for a little while because we know that not everybody has a chance to see this movie within the first 2 days or 3 days of it coming out. And then we will let you know and we'll move into spoilers and talk some specifics about the film. Before we do that, two quick bits of business, I suppose. The first is that I have to thank Miko Vanika for your donation to FThisMovie.net. Thank you very, very much. And secondly, I just want to remind anyone who is in the Chicago area or Chicago adjacent that this Friday kicks off the Chicago Critics Film Festival. It's a week's worth of really cool movies, a lot of premieres, many celebrity guests. Aubrey Plaza and Kate Micucci are going to be there on opening night. Pat Healy is going to be there for the film that he just directed, called Take Me. Richard Kelly is going to be there presenting a 35mm print of Southland Tales for its 10th anniversary. John Carroll Lynch is going to be there. Noel Wells is going to be there for two movies that they're showing back to back. And the closing night film is, I feel terrible that I cannot remember the exact name of it. I want to say it's called A Ghost Story.
Starring, I think that's true.
Yeah, starring Casey Affleck. It is the new David Lowery movie, if you're a fan of him. So there's a lot of cool movies that are going to be showing this week. Every year I see a lot of stuff that I really, really love. So if you can make it out for one night or all the nights, please do. Commercial over.
Yeah, I was looking on the website and I was getting super jealous because I'm Chicago adjacent at the moment. So I can't quite make it, but I am jealous.
This podcast is the most Chicago adjacent you've been in a while.
I'm feeling pretty adjacent at the moment.
Eric Asperschlager, have you seen anything good lately?
I have seen some good things. I have seen some not as good things. I'm going to talk about both of them, if that's all right. I know you asked specifically for good things.
Yeah, but it's really just a figure of speech. I'm happy to hear you talk about bad things,
No,
too.
I mean, it would be weird if you went about saying, hey, have you seen anything bad lately?
Right. Seen anything that's hated lately?
Not a great way to start a podcast. It's a great way to start a Twitter website, Twitter web conversation, but not a podcast. Anyway, so we're talking about a comic book movie tonight. So I said, hey, what are some comic book movies that are available for streaming for free that I can put on and watch? And I started watching Civil War again.
Okay.
And as seems to be my habit or my tendency with Marvel movies, I really liked what I saw. I watched about half an hour and then I went to do something else and never went back to it. I can't go back and watch Marvel movies. What I saw, I really liked. So I'm not going to talk about that.
I have a very similar relationship with Marvel.
I don't know
movies.
What it is. Yeah. I mean, I'm sure we'll talk about the whole Marvel experience at some point this evening. But for right now, we'll say still seems cool. Didn't go back and watch the whole thing.
Yeah.
I did rewatch Guardians. I still like that. We'll talk about that, I'm sure, later. And then I also watched for the first times Batman v Superman and Suicide Squad, because those are both on HBO streaming at the moment. And I did not particularly care for either of them. And I know it's weird to come back like a year, like you said, a year or two later. I don't know how long it's been since these movies came out.
Just over a year for Batman v Superman and just under a year for Suicide Squad. So yeah, that's in the sweet spot.
Okay. Good. So, I mean, basically, I feel like it's not something I can go on Twitter and start like, you know, talking about, because it's like, you know, where were you, you know, welcome to last year type of a thing. And the world moves fast today, Patrick. I don't know if you've noticed, but the world moves very quickly.
I've noticed.
So I can't go back and talk about these things, but I will say, and I won't say a lot about them, because I think a lot of the criticisms people had, I think, are apt. You know, I found things to be confusing and not well laid out and all that kind of stuff. I will say, people really seem to come away from at least Batman v Superman. And the most positive thing a lot of people can say was that, well, I would really like to see a Batman movie set in this universe. And I would say, based on what I saw in that movie, I would not like to see a Batman movie set in that universe. Nothing about what I saw really piqued my interest that much, especially after seeing Suicide Squad, where it's like some of the interesting stuff in Batman v Superman, some of the world building that they do. It's like, oh, this is a world where the Joker exists and where Robin was killed. It's like, okay, well, now I've met the Joker, and so I don't care to go back and find out more about his story.
No, for sure. No,
I have to say, but you know, it's I mean, it is fascinating to see how, and you know, I don't want to pile on, but it's fascinating to see how, you know, WB is trying to kind of jump in halfway and try to like immediately build what Marvel's been doing for the past 10 years. And it's hard. It's hard work. Like, Marvel struggled, I think, a lot early on, and people, it's super, you know, popular and successful now. I think a lot of people are getting burned out on the Marvel movies, but whatever you can say about them, they figured out a way to make this franchise thing a reality, and DC just isn't there yet, but they're kind of acting like they are. And
well, they still, their movies make a ton of money. It's just
sure.
That a lot of people seem to not like them. There are certainly fans. There are people who are, you know, hardcore DC movie fans, and that's great. It seems like most of what I hear is people not really loving them.
Sure.
Whereas, you know, while there are critics of Marvel movies, it seems like people in general feel positive towards that whole company or that franchise. So it's kind of like they're reversed. But so far, you know, these DC movies have made a bunch of money.
Sure. And
that's worth.
I at least now feel like I'm caught up, so that if Wonder Woman turns out to be accidentally good, that I can go and see it and enjoy myself. I shouldn't say that. That was mean. But I think that there was a headline recently. I really only read headlines these days. I'm part of the problem. But I saw a headline recently where, you know, Chris Pratt was interviewed and said that the problem he had with the Suicide Squad is that, you know, they're rushed to the characters. And there was some quote along the lines of, you know, each of these characters should have a trilogy of movies so we can get to know them. Probably said tongue in cheek. Again, I only read the headline, but that's the kind of comment people can jump on and say, we don't need more trilogies, we don't need more movies. But, you know, I can see what he means. You know, when I watch these Marvel movies now and I say, I feel like I know these characters because I've spent all this time with them. If someone said, okay, we're gonna set out to do 3 Deadshot movies, 3 Harley Quinn movies, and again, with these characters, not sure I'd be interested. But the idea of, you know, how do you do this, I think, is worth exploring. So anyway,
they really just needed to watch, you know, the Dirty Dozen, because there doesn't need to be more movies to set up these characters, at least for Suicide Squad, before we can see them together. They just need to make one ensemble movie the right way. And I don't really think they did, because it was like each person is just introduced with a montage and a pop song.
Sure. And it's probably not even fair to kind of, I guess it's fair at this point to look at the movies that exist in the so-called DC cinematic universe and say, this cinematic universe is not something I want to spend time in, only because the movies themselves are not great. If they made a great movie with these characters, then I'd be on board, like, automatically. And
absolutely.
I feel like it's just that there's only been a handful. They've, to me, been kind of, you know, good to, you know, good at best, not very good on the other end. And you know, Suicide Squad, there's some interesting stuff there, but they just fumble it from beginning to end. So even the part, like, people say, well, the first 20 minutes is good, I didn't even like the first 20 minutes. So I'm
no, because it's a kind of an extended music video.
Yeah,
yeah, I don't know. Anything else that you saw?
Yes, yes. Okay, so, and this, I guess, comes from a sad place, but, you know, Jonathan Demme passed away recently, and in a lot of the retrospectives, I realized, you know, there's a lot of Jonathan Demme movies I haven't gotten around to seeing, which always happens during these sad occasions, and I feel like, you know, the fakest of movie fans ever because I miss all this stuff. So I went back, and I saw Something Wild for the first time, and I loved it, of course.
That makes me happy.
Great. And but the movie that really stuck with me is was Rachel Getting Married.
Yes.
And that, I think, what's great about that movie, and there's so many things that are good about it, and I really do love movies that where you feel like you're kind of coming into an existing world midway through a story. You get a taste of it, and then you kind of just step out, and you feel like it continues on. And that's a movie that definitely has that. All the characters feel lived in. And I think what's so great about it is that even these people who you see for maybe 5 seconds on screen feel totally lived in and real. And everyone gets kind of little moments and little, you know, little things to do that are memorable and interesting. And you can really feel, you know, the love they have for Rachel's sister and her soon to be husband and this, you know, this event. So even though it is sort of the, you know, the story of a recovering addict who's, you know, reconnecting with her family and the drama and the struggles that have to do with that, there's so much more just to the tapestry of it. That's just really, really wonderful. And I was about to say not to get political, but I was really just going to talk about the, you know, basic human kindness, which unfortunately in 2017
has been politicized. Right.
Which is apparently counts as being political, but I think a movie like this is really important for people to see because so many movies are these days, especially big blockbusters, are movies about the chosen one, about like here is the person who is not only the unquestioned hero of this story and the most important person that you'll see, but is probably going to have to save the entire universe at some point. In this movie or series of movies that we're going to make a franchise out of. And Rachel Getting Married is a movie where, you know, you realize that in life, not only are we not, you know, the heroes of our own stories, but we're really only sometimes the lead for part of a side plot in a much larger story. Like, you know, there are a lot of stories. Everyone has a story. And I think that's super important because there are a lot of people kind of yelling at each other's Twitter handles right now. And you sit back and realize, okay, this person, you know, this, you know, MAGA great 78 has people who love them probably and has, you know, has a life, has a family, has a whole, you know, history to them. I can't pretend to know them. I can disagree with them and I can argue with them, but I really, you know, these are people, you know, and I think a movie like Rachel Getting Married kind of speaks to that, which I like. So,
me too.
I went from bashing Suicide Squad to praising humanity. I could.
Those two things are weirdly inextricably entwined.
Get you a podcaster who can do both. Is all I'm saying.
I've been actually a little bit reluctant to revisit Rachel Getting Married. I remember going to see it when it was out and loving it so much. It was my favorite movie of the year that it came out, and it cast such a spell that I'm afraid to revisit it for fear that the spell will be broken. Mm-hmm. And I was really happy when we were doing that Jonathan Demme retrospective where we all kind of talked about, you know, some of our favorite movies. I wanted to talk about it and didn't really have space to because I was mostly focused on Something Wild. So I was really happy that Alejandra brought it up and talked about, you know, Demme's work with kind of female protagonists and that he was a director who had a lot of female protagonists in his films and how important that was. And so that was really cool. I was really happy that she said some really great things about that movie.
Yeah. Even Melanie Griffith in Something Wild isn't just, you know, the wacky,
right,
you know, sexy fun chick. There's,
right,
there's a real like history and kind of intelligence.
There's
to
a
it,
person so. There. Right.
Absolutely.
And that was his gift was, I remember seeing maybe 2 years ago, I finally caught up with Ricky and the Flash. So that was his last kind of narrative feature about Meryl Streep, who's kind of a grown-up version of the Anne Hathaway character in Rachel Getting Married. She kind of walked out on a family and she plays in this bar band and she comes back for a wedding And she's just kind of a train wreck of a person who causes chaos everywhere she goes. And there's all this stuff built into her character where she's it's suggested that she's very right wing. She bashes Obama a lot. And the movie is not political. That's just part of her character. And it's not even used to make a point about her character. It's not Demi as a liberal filmmaker saying this person is a bad person because she's anti-Obama. It's just part of her character. And I so appreciate the fact that he's able to just build in. And that, you know, that credit for that also goes to Diablo Cody, who wrote the screenplay, that they're able to build in these traits that are just part of who this person is. It doesn't affect the plot. It's not designed to make us feel one way or the other. It's just to round out a human being.
Right. Real people aren't elevator pitches. That's what I always say. That's what I just said right now. Put that on a bumper sticker if you'd like. Maybe I'll make that my Twitter bio. I'm not exactly sure.
You have so many decisions to make.
I have a lot of decisions to make. I'm a complicated person. No, I'm not.
Anything else that you wanted to mention?
Nope, okay. Not at all. Go on.
I have just, I think, three very brief things that I will talk about, and none of them are great, unfortunately. The first is, for whatever reason, I was scrolling through my cable's on-demand menu looking for something I had never seen. And instead settled on something that I had seen years ago and didn't really like. And I was hoping to revisit it and like it more. And that is 976 Evil. The lone, I believe, directorial effort of Robert Englund. And it's such a relic of its period. Sometimes in a good way. I like how certain horror movies in the late 80s were dealing with these specific phenomenons, whether it's heavy metal music in Trick or Treat or 976 Evil, which is, you know, talking about not only kids who worship the devil, which was kind of the great fear of parents everywhere, but also, you know, this is when we were being inundated with all these hotlines that you could call that were, you know, $4 for the first minute and 99 cents each additional minute. And this is, you know, you have a direct line to the devil, basically. And Stephen Jeffries, who plays Evil Ed in Fright Night, is an unusual screen presence, and is this kind of nerdy kid who fights back against bullying after he's imbued with the powers of Satan because he calls 976 evil. There's so many things on the page that to me smacked of like, maybe this is a horror movie that we've slept on. You know, as I've said before, almost every horror movie, if you give it enough time, people come around on and they're like, well, that's secretly good. And so I will admit that part of me was hoping that 976 Evil was better than I remembered it, because it has all these elements that I think are good, or you know, it has something going for it, but the movie is still not very good.
That's sad.
That is my non-recommendation of 976 Evil, a movie no one is talking about or thinking of seeing. I also watched a comedy from last year, the year before, called Search Party, which has shown up on HBO, and it's one of these movies that has a cast of actors who you see in so many comedies now. There's Adam Pally from Happy Endings. There's TJ Miller from a lot of movies. There's Thomas Middleditch from Silicon Valley. There's Alison Brie. There's J.B. Smoove. There's Kristen Ritter from, Jessica Jones. Jason Mantzoukas. I mean, it's like kind of a who's who of modern comedy stars. And you would think with that cast that it would at least be funny, but it's not. It's, you know, two friends have to go save their friend from, he's stranded in Mexico after his bride-to-be runs off on their wedding day because TJ Miller messes it up. And it's the kind of movie that like seems born from the success of The Hangover, and takes all the stuff about The Hangover that was shrill and unpleasant and just makes that into a movie. So it's a bunch of people for whom you have affection or who have been funny or good in other things, just shouting at and or irritating one another. And it was 90 laugh-free minutes.
I think that was on the poster, wasn't it?
It should have been. The last movie that I will talk about just showed up on Netflix, and it's called Handsome, a Netflix Mystery. That's in the title. When the title comes up on screen, it's called Handsome, a Netflix Mystery. and it stars Jeff Garlin. It's another one of these movies with a bunch of people that you know and like. Jeff Garlin plays a detective whose last name is Handsome, and it's a murder mystery, but the murderer reveals himself before the movie starts. There's a little cameo where the actor speaks directly to camera and announces himself as the murderer in the movie. And then the mystery plays out, and you know, Columbo used to do a thing where they would tell you up front who the murderer was, and the joy was watching Columbo outsmart everyone as they all thought he was clueless. You know, that everyone underestimated Columbo, and that was the joy. And so then we get in the last scene, oh, one more thing, and then he talks about, here's how I figured it out. And that was always fun, because Peter Falk was fun to watch in that role and had a part to play. And I realized watching Handsome, a Netflix mystery, that I like these kinds of lighthearted mystery. You know, I watched after the fact, like I watched a lot of Psych. I watched a lot of Monk. You know, it's kind of like low stakes mystery, sort of comedic. And it's usually rooted in the fact that the detective has a distinct personality and is someone we want to watch solve crimes. You know, it's built out of the Columbo vein. And the problem that I had with Handsome, which is perfectly pleasant and like 81 minutes and forgotten by minute 85, is that it just doesn't have a voice. It doesn't. I mean, Jeff Garlin essentially plays Jeff Garlin. There's a few decent supporting characters. Natasha Lyonne is kind of doing something funny as his partner, but for the most part, it's all just so thin and forgettable that if it was the pilot of a TV show, I don't know that I would continue watching, even though I just said I like these kinds of shows. It certainly seems more suited for a TV show, but even then, there's not enough to hook me to wanting to see more of it.
That's too bad. I feel like
that might have been your response to all three of those reviews.
It is too bad. It's always too bad. I like, and especially since I used to watch the ever loving crap out of those USA shows. I don't know what it was, but characters were welcome in my house
they're super watchable.
About 3.5 years from like 2007 to like 2010.
I literally could not wrap my head around when Adam and Mike went to Comic-Con a couple years ago. Their wives, or Adam's wife, Allison, and a friend, their friend Nancy, were going to wait in line for like a Psych panel. And I was like, who watches Psych? I've seen commercials. No one watches Psych. So then I was like, all right, just to placate them, I'll check out an episode or two of Psych, because it was on Netflix at the time. And then I was like, oh, actually, I kind of enjoyed this. And I watched a lot of Psych. I don't know that I ever got through the whole series, but I got pretty far.
Well, we were there. We were there day one. We were there. Psych pilot episode, USA, DVR. We were all over.
I enjoyed it. It's super easy to have on, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I reviewed, I don't know how many seasons of Monk I reviewed for Verdict. And I got entered into a contest. So somewhere in a closet, I have a framed square of Monk's suit. The actual suit from the show. I have a framed square of fabric.
You are deep into entered. This, man.
I don't know how I got entered into this contest, but I won.
By the way, I reviewed Monk, the complete series.
Okay.
And admitted that, you know, I didn't have a chance to get through the entire series because that would be impossible. But like, there's nothing harder than trying to review season after season of a show that never changes.
No, absolutely.
By the time I was on season, you know, 6 or 7 of Boy Meets World, I was like, I don't know what to say anymore, people. This is the show. This is what it is. If you like it, get this DVD. If you don't, why are you reading this?
Stay tuned for our spinoff Monkcast, the defective detective.
Right, except for like, he got a new partner this season. Like, what else do you say season after season?
And you watch enough of them, and before too long, I was like, I know who the murderer is after 5 seconds.
It's the guest star.
Right.
Of course.
So, yeah, anyway, Columbo's great. And
Handsome is just okay.
Handsome's just okay, and the rest of it's too bad.
All right, let's talk about Guardians of the Galaxy.
Let's talk about
Volume 2, spoiler-free. Let's get your initial reactions to Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2, which blew up the box office this weekend, making over $150 million, which is about a $60 million jump from the opening weekend of Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 1, and I believe represents the largest leap ever for Marvel from a Part 1 to a Part 2.
Wow.
So, you know, and again, that always speaks to, hey, people liked the first movie, you know? In a lot of cases, it's like there's a jump from 1 to 2, and then if nobody likes volume, or, you know, part 2, then there's a big drop off for 3. So we'll see how 3 does, because obviously it's already been announced. But what was your reaction to Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2?
Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2 was very good. No, I liked it a lot. I liked the first one a lot too. I know, yeah, that's too bad. No, I feel like, you know, that jump that you're just talking about reflects a lot of what was kind of being said around about Guardians of the Galaxy. I think before people started to see it, but just the idea like what are they making this movie for? Who are these characters? They're taking this huge chance. I mean, a lot of it was kind of think piece nonsense, but
yeah.
You know, I mean, I thought, who, a new James Gunn movie that's also a superhero space movie? I'm in.
Yeah.
And I saw that movie twice in the theaters, which probably doesn't sound like much for most people, but is very rare for me. I almost never do that. I probably would go to see this another time if that was even possible in my current life. But yeah, I loved the first one. I was super excited for the second one. It got I felt like the reception that I was seeing, or the kind of the general reviews that I was seeing on Twitter, were super positive. And then I realized I follow James Gunn and he retweets all that stuff. So I was probably getting kind of a skewed response. And then people that I know and trust started to say they really liked it. So then I was like, well, I've been going in with too high expectations. This is dangerous. But I really, really, really enjoyed it. I thought it was great.
Yeah, I thought it was a lot of fun. You know, I thought it was very entertaining. I thought it was mostly a satisfying time at the movies. Every time we review one of these big kind of comic book franchise movies, I'm sure I make this point, but it's getting harder and harder to talk about them for the same reason that it's hard to talk about season 5 of Monk, because it's just like, what do we say this time? Was this a good installment or a bad installment? But also because all the dialogue around these movies tends to be like, best Marvel movie yet, better than the first one, not as good as the first one. Where does it fall in my ranking of the Marvel movies? And it's like, can't we just talk about the movie and not necessarily its place within this larger framework of, you know, 15 other movies or whatever? I thought it was fun. I don't know. Now I'm going to do the thing that I was just complaining about. Like, I don't know if I liked it as much as the first movie, because again, the first movie did have that kind of element of surprise where you just weren't sure what James Gunn was going to do on a movie of this scale, if these characters would translate to the screen, how it was all going to work. And the fact that he succeeded really, really well, I think, Guardians of the Galaxy is still probably one of my favorites, if not, you know, my favorite of kind of this recent run of these Marvel movies. So with that gone, now it becomes like, okay, well, I hope this one's good also. It doesn't have the element of surprise because you go in expecting him to do good work again. And again, I liked it. I had a really good time. I like these characters. I like the actors. I like the world that he sets up. I think it has a lot of really good humor. I think it subverts a bunch of the tropes that we've become maybe a little bit tired of. I think it also is too quick to cave into some of those tropes. And I have some issues with the storytelling and the villain stuff, and I think one of the characters gets pretty majorly short shrifted. So it's not, I'm not going to sit here and say like, it's perfect. It's a home run 10 out of 10 or whatever other people say when they're describing movies. But I had a really good time. And if I have complaints about it, it's really only because we're talking about it for an hour. You know, if someone were to ask me like, hey, should I go see Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2? I would say, oh, absolutely. You're probably going to have a lot of fun. It's only go ahead.
I rewatched, like I said, the first Guardians just this past week, and I hadn't seen it since I saw it at the theater. And I still liked it a whole lot. I'm glad I did. And again, I hate those comparisons too, but I'm going to compare it too. I actually think I like the second one a little bit more than the first one.
Okay.
And I made this comparison to Adam on Twitter the other night, but I feel like Guardians of the Galaxy 2 to me is sort of like Spider-Man to Spider-Man 2, Raimi's Spider-Man to Spider-Man 2. That, you know, the first one's a great origin story, you know, well told, great characters, sets up the world, has a lot of fun. And the second one, I think, in both cases, delivers on an emotional level. You know, for me, I think it probably depends on how, you know, jaded and cynical you are. I guess I'm less so than you, but I thought it really kind of worked really well for me. I may be in that kind of that Marvel movie high, which is also my alma mater, but I really like what they did with the characters and the themes in the world. And you're right. I mean, it's every time these movies come out, I super, super, super hate the rankings. I think it's difficult to talk about these movies. And I think it probably is impossible to talk about them just as individual movies because they aren't that. And I have, you know, Doctor Strangelove stopped worrying about all that stuff now. I see the Marvel Cinematic Universe, TM as its own thing. Like, these are not so much sequels. They aren't sequels as much as they are the movie equivalent of comic books to me, or trade paperbacks, or whatever. Like they really have made the movie equivalent of buying and reading comics. There are crossovers. There are, you know, each one is kind of its own issue. It is an ongoing story. I no longer see that as a negative. I'm not going to hold these up as individual movies against other really great individual movies that exist only as movies and not part of a franchise.
The good news is those don't exist anymore.
Yeah. So that's mostly getting gone. You know, in fact, they just announced Rachel getting married too. Rachel getting divorced, coming out this fall, I believe. But, I've already kind of taken myself out of that. I no longer think about it this way. I think the Guardians, is able to sidestep a lot of the stuff, a lot of that kind of fatigue that we get with some of the Avengers series of movies, mm-hmm. only because it takes place. This is only the second of the kind of the cosmic movies that we've gotten, really. So even though this takes place within the larger Marvel movie universe, it also just feels like the second space movie, you know, in the Marvel thing. We're going to get more of that, I think, probably going forward. I'm really super, super looking forward to Thor Ragnarok. And it gets me to the point again where, like, I hate the ranking. I hate the whole, like, okay, I have to look at all these movies and say, am I a little too excited because it's the newest one?
Right.
And every year, like, I always get excited for the comic book movies and then they let me down. But I have to say, this year, I'm probably the most excited for comic book movies that have been in a while. Like, even if Spider-Man Homecoming isn't great, and I'm still you know, tentatively excited for it. Like, at least if we get Guardians and if Thor Ragnarok is even half as good as I expect from its pedigree, then I'll be very happy with my comic book movies this year.
Thor Ragnarok looks incredible just based on the one trailer. Again,
right.
You know, it expresses a tone and a point of view. Wonder Woman, you know, we can be hopeful about Wonder Woman. I'm not cynical about Wonder Woman yet.
It could be good.
And Spider-Man Homecoming, I will say I saw a new trailer before Guardians of the Galaxy. Did you also see that trailer?
I didn't. Our local theater only, it's actually nice. Our local theater shows like two trailers and then they get right into the movie, but I didn't see that one.
I saw probably eight trailers and it's just one after another, just crushing me and they're for movies I, you know, want to see, but it's just like, oh my God, another one. The first Spider-Man Homecoming trailer I liked and it got me excited, and this new one I did not like at all. And I was like, uh-oh, this looks terrible. But I think it's just an example of a bad trailer and hopefully not a bad movie. I too really like that Guardians of the Galaxy is able to exist more or less independently of all the other Marvel stuff. And I would say this one, even more than the first one, is more removed, because the first one you had all the kind of Thanos and Infinity Stone stuff.
Yeah.
And this movie is really not bothering with any of that stuff. And on the one hand, because it's already been announced that they will factor into, you know, Avengers 3 and 4. So I'm, in one way, I'm excited to see them interact with the other characters, just as a comic book fan and as a fan of what Marvel is kind of building. And at the same time, I'm like, nah, I'd almost rather they never intersect and just keep my peanut butter and jelly separate or whatever, you know, because
once, just submit already. Come on, join
once,
us.
Yeah, once they're in, then it's like, well, now they're in forever. And, you know, who knows? Whatever. I'm getting ahead of myself. But I thought the movie was fun. And like you said, I appreciate the fact that it doesn't have to do a bunch of setting up the characters. It doesn't have to do a, it doesn't have to introduce them to one another. It just can kind of start in motion, and we know who they are, and we know that they're a team. And so the opening of the film is a lot of fun because we get to see them working as a team, sort of. James Gunn takes a bit of a turn with that. But then, without getting into spoilers yet, I find myself a little bit frustrated because I think James Gunn does a thing that some other sequels do, which frustrates me. A, I think it separates the team more than I would like. If we're at the point where we want to see them be the Guardians of the Galaxy together, then let them be that. You don't have to send them on three or four different missions. And two, it resets some of the relationships back to zero. So part one is about, hey, how do these guys get along and work as a team? And then part two is like, how do they still get along and work as a team? And I found that to be a little bit dramatically unsatisfying.
Yeah, when we're flirting with spoiler territory. I'll keep it very vague as well. I know exactly what you're talking about. I think that if you compare what happens in this movie to say, I think probably the worst recent example of that, which would be Star Trek Into Darkness. It does not reset it to that degree.
No, I
don't even know that it really reset it that much. I think that it's a good balance. I did not have a problem, and usually I hate it when the movie like immediately starts and splits everyone up. I really don't like that at all. But he made it work in this case, and I thought that some of the ways that it echoes some pretty successful sequels that do a similar thing, I think worked to its advantage. So I did not have a problem with it. We will talk more about that in spoilers.
I like also, you know, sometimes with these kind of team dynamic movies, certain members of the team get obviously the short shrift and are more or less forgotten because we have to pay more attention to our hero or our movie star or whoever. And it really does feel like, and that was one of the things I liked about the first movie, and it's one of the things I like here, where each character gets a number of beats where they get to shine either in an action sequence or dramatically. You know, it's not just, ooh, we get to see Gamora do this one cool fight move. She also gets her own kind of storyline that needs to be resolved. And I kind of like that it isn't completely dependent on Star-Lord, you know, her dramatic arc is separate from the will they or won't they stuff that they do incorporate into the movie. But it's not just, I can't figure out if I like a boy. Like, that is not her dramatic arc in the movie. And I feel like everybody gets, you know, one or two or three, however many cool kind of action things that they get to do. But then they also get some really nice character moments that are a lot more dramatically satisfying.
Yeah, I think that the character stuff in this movie is great. I think it's great that that James Gunn found ways to take characters who were either not terribly well developed or really kind of side characters in the first movie, at least one in particular, make them into a fully fleshed out character that we now kind of understand and kind of care about, and even introduces new characters who I also now, you know, care about and kind of want to see where they go. So he does a really good job, I think, with all the character stuff. There's a lot of, I think, kind of character shorthand, and some of the thematic elements of the movie may almost a little too on the nose. I think he balances it really well. Nothing really bothered me. And I think a slightly more jaded viewer might take some of it and kind of roll their eyes. I was charmed by it all, but I think the character work in this movie is really, really well done. And that's kind of where I draw some of the comparisons between Spider-Man, Spider-Man 2, that kind of thing, where, you know, now that we know who they are, let's build on that a bit. We know the backstories. Let's kind of explore some of the elements of the characters and make them into you know, resonant things in this story.
Right. I agree with all the character stuff. I will say that maybe I am that more jaded viewer because one of the issues that I have with the movie is how much characters have to state the subtext and explain exactly what they are thinking or feeling, or another character explains exactly what somebody is thinking or feeling, to the degree that one of the characters is an empath, who that is her function to explain what the character won't say. And we'll talk about more examples in spoilers, but I mean, there's a whole thing where like a character just speaks the lyrics of a song because it applies to the situation that we're in. And it's like, well, we could probably pick up on some of that, but no, you go ahead and make those connections for us.
Look, Patrick, if you have never, you know, zeroed in on the lyrics to a song and said them either to yourself or to someone else and said, whoa, this is like exactly like what's happening right now, you've either never been a college student, never been stoned, which is very possible. I haven't either. But I mean, yeah. You know, I do that. Like, that's a thing. I think it works, especially in the context of like what that particular character is trying to do. Again, we can get into that in spoilers.
Yeah.
We're going to have a little sisterly battle, I think.
It comes back again at the end, though, where it's like, remember that thing we said a little while ago? Let me repeat it. Whatever. It's fine. None of these things are deal breakers, you know, because, again, I enjoy the movie and I like living in this world. And I think that's what it comes down to more than anything else, because I really liked Captain America: Civil War. And I thought it did a really nice job of balancing so many different characters, so many different storylines. It's sort of the culmination of all these movies to this point. And I had fun watching them fight each other at the airport. And I had just so much admiration for what they pulled off. But as you had said at the beginning of the show, like, I'm rarely compelled to revisit it. For as much as I like these characters, for as much as I've grown up reading these characters, these aren't necessarily worlds that I want to live in for whatever reason, for 2 hours, 2.5 hours, whatever it may be. Whereas I find the original Guardians of the Galaxy, and I suspect Volume 2, very rewatchable, much more rewatchable than most of the Marvel movies for me. And that's because I like to live in the world that James Gunn has created. It has energy and color, and it's fun, and it's funny, and it feels different. And I like visually what he does. Let me ask you this. Did you see the movie in 3D?
I did not.
Nor did I, because I don't really like 3D, as I've said before. But I will say there were a lot of times in the movie that I was watching thinking, this seems designed for 3D, and I'll bet is pretty cool in that format.
Right. I mean, I think, you know, it's totally non-spoiler thing to say that this is a beautiful movie, and it's gorgeous, some gorgeous stuff in it. And I think that the fact that it's set in space just gives you endless possibilities to make super cool stuff that you couldn't really do in, like, you know, New York or something like that in an Avengers movie. So it really, the colors on the poster are not just the colors
right,
on the poster.
Right.
Like, that is the palette for this movie.
And I was really wishing, I don't think my local theater is doing this, because unfortunately most times if you want to see a movie projected in IMAX, you have to see it in 3D. But there were so many shots. Oftentimes they were establishing shots, but sometimes it was just one character sitting, and this is not a spoiler, there's a shot of Gamora essentially sitting in a field at one point, and she's very small and the scenery around her is very large, and there were just all these scenes that I wished I could see projected in IMAX. There's a scene of Groot looking out the window of the Milano as the ship pulls away. There were all these just moments that I felt were really built for the biggest screen possible, and I so appreciate that at a time when, you know, even Marvel movies that are big, quote unquote big and expensive, I don't think are always visually big. They feel sometimes built for TV almost. And this movie, you know, is really thinking cinematically, and I really appreciate that.
Sure. And based solely on the trailer for Thor Ragnarok, it seems like Taika Waititi has similar ideas about how to do really cool big stuff. So
yes, I'm we shall see for that movie.
I know. Yeah. It's space. We love space.
I guess. Yeah. I mean, so much of it just has to do with like the laser font. I'm just you have to trust somebody with taste like that. You know.
Look, you don't have to look. You can. I'm sorry. That's Alexa. she recently moved in. It's kind of a pain. Doesn't pay any rent. Shut up, Alexa. All right. I don't know what I said. Anyway, but yes, Thor, Ragnarok, not Alexa. It looks pretty cool. So,
all right. Let's get into spoilers for Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2. If you have not seen the film yet, please turn the episode off and come back when you've seen the movie. Or if you're somebody who just doesn't care about spoilers, you can continue to listen. But spoilers for the movie in 3, 2, 1. I liked all the character stuff. I found the storytelling lacking in the film. Again, I thought the character arcs were interesting and I keep saying dramatically satisfying, but I want to stress that. But I found the actual storytelling, because if you were to, you know, beat out the plot of this movie, Star-Lord gets the battery, is chased, crashes, goes to Kurt Russell's planet, and then stands in a room and is explained stuff essentially for the rest of the movie. And that to me was disappointing.
I liked that.
Okay.
In part because this sort of hit me at a certain point in the movie that, hey, this is the whole part, I think, where they're on Ego's planet, which I guess is Ego.
Right.
It reminded me a bit of like a Star Trek episode. And that maybe I'm talking to the wrong guy, because you're going to tell me why it's not. But like, there's something about it that's like, oh, I kind of like that people are just standing around discussing ideas. And you know, they're not necessarily the deepest of ideas.
And
but
then maybe that's the problem, is if they were discussing ideas that got you thinking, then okay, great. But they weren't really.
I mean, I think what I like about the movie, even though the kind of themes of like family and what does it mean to be a father and a son and a child and siblings and to build a family, all those things, which I think are explored and pulled in a ton of different directions, which is what I really appreciate about the movie, is that kind of everybody comes at it from a different point of view. So even though those themes are spelled out very clearly, and you know, there's really no there's no subtlety in the message that, you know, this is about family. James Gunn explores a ton of different aspects of that. I mean, you have obviously Ego as kind of the selfish parent who doesn't understand what it means to love, and is in fact kind of feels threatened by those feelings, and what he does to Peter Quill's mother ultimately. And then you have, you know, Yondu, who keeps it a secret and, you know, ends up being, you know, Peter Quill's real father in a sense. I mean, that kind of caught me off for whatever, like the end of that movie, like really, really kind of touched me, the whole, you know, Yondu sacrifice and the Ravagers, you know, tribute to him, like all of that, like really. You know, it doesn't hurt that the soundtrack is, I think, probably even better than the first one. There's a lot going on. You know, Nebula and Gamora, what it means to be sisters, and them being pitted against each other by Thanos, and Nebula's backstory, I thought was, you know, I mean, none of it is super deep, but it works for me. I mean, if you look at it, even just as kind of comic book storytelling, there's going to be a lot of shorthand. There's going to be a lot of kind of big ideas that are kind of presented in a straightforward way, but none of that really felt off to me. None of it felt lazy. I mean, the fact that James Gunn is so good with, you know, using humor and all that stuff, it really just, it worked for me. And maybe I'm just on board. Maybe I'm just, you know, in this bubble. But I didn't have a problem with it.
No, I mean, I don't mean to suggest that I'm not on board.
And, why do you hate this movie, Patrick?
I'm glad that you that you liked it. I liked it too. Again, I want to stress, I really enjoyed this movie and totally agree with you.
I'm going to make you say that like 20 more times.
I totally agree with you that I appreciate the fact, I don't think, as you said, it was very subtle in terms of the way that it says, hey, this is about family. Because again, every conversation between Gamora and Nebula is just, I wanted a sister and why couldn't you be my sister and you're my sister. I appreciate, again, like I said, that they have a story that's separate from Star-Lord, that's separate from just, hey, you were the bad guy in the last movie and I don't like you. And it's about them coming together. I appreciate that the movie is about something other than just, hey, we're in space and isn't this fun and we're heroes and what does it mean to be a hero? Because, you know, as much, did you see Doctor Strange?
You know, I have not seen that one.
Okay.
Yet.
It's fine. It's fun. It's, you know, whatever. It's essentially Iron Man. You know, it's like, I was overconfident and now I'm humbled and I have to build myself back up to being a hero. And that's fine, but I didn't feel like it was necessarily about larger ideas beyond, hey, what does it mean to be a hero, which is what so many of the Marvel movies have already been about. So I like that Guardians of the Galaxy 2 is coming at it from a different angle. I totally agree that the Yondu stuff really works and, you know, he's not a huge part of the movie for the first two thirds. And then all of a sudden you find yourself really moved in the last third. And all, the entire movie has essentially built to being about him and his sacrifice. And part of that is, you know, part two, we just have to always Wrath of Khan somebody. But the way that they do it works. And Michael Rooker's performance, I thought, was really good. I really like his scenes with Chris Pratt. I like
that, you know, the themes of family even extend to, you know, the Ravagers and
how his
crew, you know, turns on him. But you have the one guy, Sean Gunn's character, who doesn't. And it, I mean, even all that I found to be compelling and kind of tied back into the theme without being like super duper, you know, over the top on the nose about it. Everything serves this kind of idea in the film,
right,
from some really different points of view. And even though, you know, maybe, you know, if the idea of like people, if the idea of family sounds trite to you, and I mean you specifically, Patrick, even though you know, probably you as well. No, but I mean, if you know, if the idea of people like being a family, if you know, if in the trailer, I think, you know, it cuts, you know, between Nebula saying, you guys aren't friends, you fight all the time, you're not even friends, and Drax saying, no, we're family. You know, I mean, that obviously super nail meathead, I guess hammer meat, nail meat. Anyway, whatever that is, it's on the nose. I understand, but it works for me. I cried. What can I say? I got tears. I got emotions.
Well,
I got emotions.
Here's the thing. It's like so many of the scenes are, no, we're family. Or Yondu and Rocket saying, like, I know you're that guy because you're me. And it's like, well, maybe Yondu, you don't need to spell that out. Because, and maybe this is just me, you know, even Yondu at the end, I think, is the one time where I forgive it being on the nose, where he says, he may have been your father, but he ain't your daddy. Like, that's super on the nose. But I can forgive that because it is such a payoff of their relationship and kind of what the whole movie has been building towards. But I think it's telling that for me, the most emotionally affecting scene in the film comes about halfway when Mantis touches Drax's arm and immediately begins weeping. He's talking about his daughter, and she touches his arm and she begins weeping, and he's just sitting there quietly. And it's like, oh, well, now here's a scene where no words are exchanged, and yet I thought it was the most emotionally affecting moment in the film because we're able to just read what's under the surface and what's happening here. And I really liked the performances of both of those actors. So I find myself wishing that sometimes James Gunn had trusted some of the relationships a little bit more without having to tell us exactly what to think or feel.
Sure. That's totally fair. I mean, there are a ton of movies I've seen where that has been my chief complaint.
They're of course.
Telling me things, just show me things.
Right.
And I think we're going to get that in Star-Lord getting married. So I think the movie where we're really going to... But we're
again, I bring these things up, you know, because we're talking about this movie for an hour. These are not things that I'm like, oh, fuck this movie. You had mentioned the soundtrack.
And that's totally fair. I was going to say, it's totally fair. And it, once again, an example of how movies either, if a movie has you under its spell, you're going to forgive a ton of stuff that you wouldn't if you're sitting there with your arms crossed waiting, looking at your watch. And I think this movie is not, I'm not going to say it's not perfect because no movie is perfect. And that's the dumbest thing people could possibly say, you know, besides ranking Marvel movies. But it's you know, it's either going to work on you or it won't. But I think the things the movie does really well, it does well. Yes. Soundtrack.
You know, I just had a quick thing about the soundtrack because you had mentioned it. And I like the song choices a lot. I feel like sometimes the movie was leaning a little bit heavily on that. And maybe the first one does. It's been maybe 2 years since I saw it. I know the first one leaned heavily on kind of some of the 70s pop and whatever. You know, there's a Fleetwood Mac cue that works really well. And I think you had brought it up in the context of Cat Stevens at the end. And my goodness, is that great. You know, that's something out of a Wes Anderson movie. Like, that's really, really great. I found myself getting irritated. Irritated is the wrong word. Okay. I just, certain things chafed me a little bit. Like, I felt like because that was such a popular component of the first movie that James Gunn was like, well, we better do a lot more of that. And so he does. The thing that irritated me the most was that it keeps having to cut back to the cassette tape to somehow explain why we're hearing the music. I just, at a certain point, like, I don't care. You know what I mean? Like, you don't need to keep telling us.
Yeah, I don't think that's why they do. I mean, I feel, again, having, look, Patrick, I'm not saying I'm the expert in Guardians of the Galaxy.
You are.
Rewatched the first movie, so you can defer to me and some of this stuff. No, when the first movie came out, I bought the mixtape Volume 1 soundtrack. I spun it constantly. And so I went into the movie kind of having already internalized those songs. And I was, I think, struck more in the first movie about how kind of inorganically some of those songs are used. They really are just music cues. He happens to be playing at certain points in the movie. I felt like the music was used more organically in this one. Okay. I mean, I think it's been established as part of his character that, you know, the guy likes this music. He listens to it. He's kind of spread it around a bit so much that the Ravagers, he's got a, Yondu almost has a copy of some of his stuff on the, which you could probably look at as a plot hole. I don't know, but it worked for me.
I think that's why I didn't need them to keep explaining where the music was coming from, because as you said, it's established. This is his character. We know that he always has music playing. It's set up early on that even Rocket is trying to get music playing because that's a part, that's a thing that they do.
Yeah.
So at a certain point, it's like, I'm no longer questioning why is this song playing. I don't, whatever.
Yeah. It's fine. I know it's because we're talking about it for so long. You have to find something. It's fine. But for me, I found the music to be kind of, it's more like a part of the world than maybe in the first movie where it's just more a part of the soundtrack.
Right.
Even though probably a lot of the times it's, you know, when they're going into nowhere and Moon Age Daydream is playing on the speakers in Milano, it is part of, you know, part of them listening to it, but it still feels like it's part of the soundtrack. Or like, you know, Cherry Bomb as they're walking toward the thing, which is a great moment, but again, it feels like more like a needle drop than it does, you know, part of the world. And I think in this one, and I also think just generally speaking, I like that the mixtape Volume 2 soundtrack has some deeper cuts, some songs that it actually took me a few listens of the soundtrack to kind of really realize how good some of these songs I hadn't heard are. It's like, I don't know Lakeshore Drive. Do I want to listen to this? Yes, I want to listen to it all the time.
How do you not know Lakeshore Drive?
I don't know because I'm not from Chicago, I guess.
Oh, all right. I love that song, and that was one of those cues. I think that's when Groot is staring out the window, yeah?
Might be, yeah.
That was one of those moments where I was like, fuck, I wish I was seeing this in IMAX because cinematic. But yeah, I love that cue.
Yeah. So there, I'm a sucker for this music anyway. So, but at the same time, having just seen, and maybe part of it's because I just saw Suicide Squad.
I was just about to say, like, for as much as it sounds like I'm nitpicking this, like, there's clearly a right way and a wrong way to do it. And Suicide Squad, I think, is the textbook example of the wrong way to do it, where it's just every song is on the nose. Every song exists just to say, like, here's who this character is. Like, if you play Spirit in the Sky on your soundtrack, you've already lost.
Well, Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 1 had Spirit in the Sky on the soundtrack. What are you saying? What are you saying? What have you done? You monster. No, I really, Yeah, I don't know. I'm in the bag for this movie. I understand that. But at the same time, like, I really loved the soundtrack. And I thought they used it in ways that was, I mean, even like Mr. Blue Sky in the opening, it probably could have been a bunch of different songs. That's a great song.
Yeah.
And that's a great opening with the kind of, the, you know, the intergalactic beast being fought like out of focus in the
back camera. Yeah, basically.
So great. So now. I was not sure how I was going to feel about Baby Groot going into this movie. How did you feel about Baby Groot?
I was fine with Baby Groot. I mean, I will admit, I found myself admiring that opening sequence more than enjoying it, because it immediately almost took me out, where I was like, I see what you're doing, James Gunn. That's amusing. And it's not that I need to watch these characters fight another CGI monster. I don't know that that would have made this a better movie, but just watching Baby Groot dance. it's almost giving you something to watch while you appreciate the trick that James Gunn is pulling off.
Sure.
Which is fine. Again, I like that the movie kind of announces itself as saying, hey, we're going to undermine some of the things that you've come to expect. And there's lots of little dialogue beats that do that, whether it's Gamora saying, you know, it's not ripe yet and I hate her, or at the end, you shouldn't have killed my mom and broke my Walkman. Like, I like that.
Yeah.
He throws jokes in there, you know? And so I appreciate the choreography of that opening sequence. And the way that it is, you know, going against what so many other movies would do. I was fine with Baby Groot. I don't think the movie leaned too heavily on him being adorable, even if he is adorable. And I like that he seems to have a relationship with each of the characters that is sort of unique. I mean, at the end of the film, he's sitting with Gamora and he hops off her and hops onto Drax, and yeah, they each have kind of a different connection to him. And again, if this is a movie about family and in many cases, you know, parents, that each of them is sort of a surrogate parent now to this little Baby Groot. So I like how it tied in thematically. I thought it did the best that it could with what could have been just kind of an obnoxious stunt.
Yep. No, I agree with all that. There are some very funny scenes with Baby Groot. I think the, you know, them sending him into the, yeah, you know, to Yondu's quarters to get the stuff, the severed toe, very funny. You know, even as kind of like silly slapstick as it is, the scene with Rocket telling him which button not to push,
right,
and asking for tape and all that stuff is very funny. And I didn't really realize it until James Gunn said it on Twitter the other day, but that, you know, that Baby Groot is not Groot again. Like, he does not have any of Groot's memories. He is essentially a new character who's just growing up now,
right?
Which I think is kind of a fascinating idea.
Yeah.
That, you know, and it really kind of explains why, even though, you know, Rocket knows that Groot can regenerate, he's so broken up about Groot's death at the end of the first movie. It's like, yeah, his friend actually did die.
Right.
He's growing a new friend, but he's not the same. He's not the same person.
Right.
Which is pretty interesting. But yeah, no, I was a little worried because I'm, you know, nothing against anyone who loves this stuff. I don't like Funko Pops. And this felt like a Funko Pop character, but they didn't make him into that at all. I think he was really, you know, charming and capable and funny and all this stuff.
And found a way to use him in a way that made sense for Baby Groot, and not just, you know, I know that sounds stupid, but like, okay, he's now this little tiny baby. What do we do with that? We can't just do Groot again, you know, as you had said. There was no he didn't have a moment as sort of transcendent as in the first movie when he beats the shit out of the guy and then gives that big smile. But that's okay, you know. Let's talk about Kurt Russell and the whole ego thing, because to me that's it pains me to say it, but that's the weakest stuff in the movie. And it's no fault of Kurt Russell, who continues to be glorious and wonderful. His de-aging effect that they do on him in the opening of the movie is almost seamless. I mean, it's.
I know. I mean, compare it, and I again because I just watched the first 20 minutes of Civil War.
Yeah,
I can say it's way better than what they did with Robert Downey Jr. in that movie.
It absolutely is. It's crazy. Like I was trying to look for like where's the waxy look? Where's that? And it's not there. It's like they just used old footage of Kurt Russell. And of course, it just makes me so happy to see him on screen. He enters the movie. He looks amazing. He has the greatest head of hair on any human being. He's got that great beard. I love seeing him. He, you know, has good comic timing where he's like, I'm going to go pee. I like him as Star-Lord's dad. I think it's interesting that he's this god who's been around for millions of years. I think the reveal is not great only because it's tipped so early on that something's off, but okay. I thought the reveal of the Cave of Skeletons was interesting and super dark. But in terms of what he wants, I don't think it's that interesting really. And unfortunately about 2/3 or 3/4 of the way through the movie, it just turns into generic Marvel villain where it's no longer Kurt Russell. It's this weird CGI proxy. And I thought the extended kind of battle sequence at the end of the film, I found overly busy. I thought it's still better than I think a lot of movies that I could easily compare it to. But at the same time, it felt a little bit to me like the movie was getting away from James Gunn a little bit. And he would reel it back in with a good line of dialogue or a character beat or whatever. But I thought a lot of that stuff became overkill at the end of the movie.
Sure. Once again, I was mostly okay with it.
I liked it.
But I have to say, no, I mean, I think that, you know, the fact that it, for so much of the movie, it seemed like it was kind of a smaller, more personal story about these characters. And then by the end, it is the universe is going to, you know, you have to save the universe again.
Right. You have to blow up the core where his consciousness is. Like, I'm really okay.
Because so many people do it, I can forgive it when it's done well in a movie that I like. And I thought they did a pretty good job with it. And I was a little unclear maybe what some of Ego's motivations are, but I can see if it's someone who basically is a god who lives alone and doesn't understand, you know, what it means to have any connection with anyone else and you feel loneliness, you're not going to actually go out and find real connections. You're going to think that what you have to do then is just to use other living beings who are beneath you to further yourself and spread yourself across the galaxy. And that when you actually encounter something like love that he, I think probably did feel for Peter Quill's mother, and you feel threatened by kind of the bond that creates, sure. You're going to try to get rid of that by killing her off. So I think I could have done without the, you know, other planets being covered by his goo.
I think literally,
literally. I think that was, it's okay, but I think they could have made it a little bit smaller and it would have been just as interesting.
Yeah.
If it was just trying to like get off the planet and to kind of save their friend and sort of get away from all that. I know. I mean, when you're on board for a movie, you can kind of forgive some of that stuff. It didn't bother me so much. I think that, you know, compare Ego to Ronan in the first movie, I think he's a much more interesting villain. Even if, you know, his motivations are kind of as simplistic. Ronan was just sort of the blue guy with the hammer who wanted to just, you know, purge the universe. Ego is a god who wants to purge the universe, but he's also Kurt Russell. So I give him the edge.
I give him the edge as well. And, you know, it's so many of these movies do kind of have a villain problem where it's like, boy, these heroes are super interesting and fun to watch. And gosh, I wish they would just give them someone worthwhile to fight. And Ronan was kind of that in the first movie where it's like, eh, he's fine, but like, he's just the bad guy, you know?
Right.
And so I kind of was hoping for this movie to improve upon that. And in some ways I think it does. I think it falls short in not. I think Kurt Russell is interesting, you know, again, for 2/3 of it. I think the last third, it just doesn't quite work. I lost the thread of like what I was going to say. One of my issues is that I almost wished that at a certain point when Star-Lord is like, no, I'm not going to do that. He just turns on a dime and he's like, ah, all right, then I'm just going to have to shoot a lightning bolt through you and use you and destroy everything. And he becomes this mustache twirling villain. And I found myself wishing that it had just followed through more on the idea of, he thinks what he's doing is right and justified. And it's not that he doesn't, but he does it in such a now I'm evil way that was so much less interesting to me than where I thought it was going to go. Does that make sense?
Sure. Yeah, it does. I think also what he was doing up to that point was manipulation. I mean, you mentioned, you know, the scene where he's quoting the lyrics to Brandy, You're a Fine Girl. And one of the reasons he's doing that is because he knows that Peter will respond to that. His goal isn't to, you know, find the son that he can play, you know, electro ball with.
Right.
It's, you know, it's to find the battery that will help him do, you know, power the universe. So even though he does turn on a dime, it's really just, you know, he's just dropping the facade of being, you know, the David Hasselhoff that he never had.
and maybe I'm just talking myself through some of this now. It's like if I didn't already suspect that something is wrong and that he's evil, I almost wish that they had played it straight for longer, because I think to have that scene where they play ball could have been so powerful, and then to have the rug yanked out from under us, I think would have been twice as powerful. But because we know something's up, it's like I don't trust the moment where they're playing ball, and I wish I could have trusted it. So that I can, do you know what I mean?
I do. I think that probably part of my response is that even if I had a vague sense that there was something wrong, I didn't suspect that. It probably sounds like naive, but I didn't necessarily see the twist coming until the Cave of Skeletons. Like I didn't know exactly what was going on.
Yeah.
I didn't, you know, and there's probably, you know, a billion reasons for that. I think what, and this may or may not be a reason why I was not suspecting it, but as this is part of my theater experience for seeing the movie, this is a small local theater, which is great. It's a very old theater. They have photos up in the lobby of like Gary Cooper and these other people who came at one point and signed pictures for them and all this stuff. It's really cool. But it's a small theater. They have basically like one screen, then they added a second screen next door. They scheduled the show times yesterday. I didn't realize this until we got there, so that the showing before us didn't end until our showing was supposed to start.
Oops.
So we go in and bought the tickets, and I can kind of hear what's going on in the thing, and I asked the ticket, you know, the lady who's selling the tickets there. I was like, so is that the end of the movie? She's like, yeah, I don't know why they scheduled it that way, but basically this movie's going to end when your movie's supposed to start. We're going to just go through, clean up really fast, then we'll start the movie. So I went with my dad. We went like outside. So like I can't stand here. I'm not going to listen to the end of the movie.
Right, right, right.
So I went outside, and there were a bunch of people who were standing outside in the rain, basically, because we didn't want to hear the end of the movie. So we're standing there as people were leaving. And again, we can't, you know, when the movie's over, but we can't go back in because the credits with all these movies, and I knew there's going to be end credit sequences. Yeah. So I can't go until it's actually over. So we're standing there. Some people are coming out, and a woman came out, and she was saying, well, I bet we're going to see stuff with that, the blue stuff in the other movie, even though his dad died.
Oh,
so
Jesus.
Like, oh man, come on, come on. So I'm like, okay, fine. All right, fine. Kurt Russell dies in the movie. I'll get over that. And now I don't know if she's talking about Kurt Russell or Yondu, you know, Igor Yondu. And so it actually ended up being this reverse situation where it unspoiled me. I was like, okay, he's gonna close to Kurt Russell and something's gonna kill him, and okay, that's fine, someone always dies in these movies, oh, you know, all this stuff. So it actually worked out in my favor, whatever it was. And I don't know that it was that necessarily, but I sort of, you know, obviously once Mantis is starting to, like, you know, give clues that something's going on, things aren't quite right, I didn't necessarily expect it. So I'm the sucker that this movie was made for, because I didn't see it all coming, you know? So, you know, so that the scene where they're throwing the ball back, That movie, I mean, that I found that moving. Okay. So I, you know, I mean.
Good. No, that's great.
It can happen.
Yeah.
All I'm saying is, you know, magic can happen.
As long as somebody spoils the movie right before you go see it, magic can happen.
Exactly. Magic can happen. There were people who went in, who were waiting for the movie. I saw a couple people like standing through. They didn't want to stand in the rain. They had their fingers in their ears. Like no one wanted to be spoiled for this movie. It was the weirdest thing. But anyway, and it worked out. In the end, it worked out.
What did you think of Mantis, since we've mentioned her a few times but haven't really talked about her?
I thought they did a fine enough job with a character that's, you know, didn't seem to have a whole lot going on. I mean, she was kind of defined by what other people were feeling. But you know, there are parallels between her and Nebula and the fact that they kind of were both, I guess, in Gamora as well, and that they kind of have a father figure who just sort of took them and did what they wanted, with them. So she kind of represents, that sort of neglected parent thing. I thought she was fine. I think that they leave plenty of room for her to be more interesting in volume 3.
Yeah.
I didn't, you know, I thought, you know, the whole kind of look and effect of her was, worked well. I think she was sort of the Nebula, the volume 1 Nebula of this movie, and that, you know, she looked cool. She definitely had a function. I hope we, you know, see more of her development in the next one.
I liked her a lot. I thought, you know, I liked her relationship with Drax. Again, you know, the movie feels the need to say, you don't have to believe in yourself. I believe in you. Like, oh, yeah, no, we get it. Like the second time where he says, you're beautiful on the inside. That's okay, because it's a joke and it pays
well,
off.
Even the I believe you thing was kind of a joke, I thought, because like right after that, after she did it, it's like, oh, I didn't think she could do it.
Right. Yeah,
look,
I guess.
It's funny. No, I don't know. No, I mean, it is. It is totally speaking the subtext. I'm not going to take that away from your hatred of this movie. I understand. I know you love it.
I didn't think you could do it. It didn't get as big a laugh from me, only because it was – that to me felt like a more predictable joke beat that I would see in a different movie. And one of the things that I really like about this movie is the way that it comes at so much of the humor from an angle that we don't expect. And that's what makes it so funny, is that it's funny in surprising ways a lot of times. You know, I think Drax really is the MVP in terms of the comedy in this movie.
Yep.
So much of what he does is really, really funny. And
I mean, even just like his laugh is so infectious.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, that like his laugh is one of the funniest jokes in the movie.
Especially, you know, while they're being shot at or being chased or whatever, and he's just
loves it.
He has that beat in the first one too, and I love it. But I thought, excuse me, that Mantis found some really fun ways to come at the humor. Also, she has a delivery. I think it's when Gamora approaches and says, "Like, what are you guys talking about?" And she says, like, that I am a pet and ugly or something. The way she delivers that line, it's so funny in such a surprising way that I thought she brought a different type of humor, a different dynamic to the group that I really liked.
I mean, it is in a lot of ways similar to Drax's kind of function in the first movie, where he just takes everything so literally.
Right.
It's kind of along those lines. But at the same time, it is different. I did like their scenes. Yeah, I thought there was really wasn't anyone in the movie that I thought was completely wasted. You know, I thought
agree.
And so I don't know. What can I say? I like the movie. I don't know. I'm the uncritical waif.
I like too that the movie softens Gamora without making her soft. She's still fierce and badass and strong and great, but she has these moments where, and this is probably a throwaway, when she first brings up the Hasselhoff thing, and he says, I told you that when I was drunk. I hate that story. I love that she says, I love that story. Like,
yeah.
I love that they've had this conversation before, and it's just, I don't know. I thought there were a lot of moments like that where, you know, in the first movie, she's much more of just the tough warrior woman who maybe likes this guy, but mostly rolls her eyes at him. You know, it's a dynamic that I think is a little bit predictable. And one of the things I really liked about Volume 2 is that it builds in a relationship between them that existed between the first movie and the second one.
Mm-hmm.
It gives them a history that we didn't have to see to know that it's there.
Yeah, and I like that even though the movie basically ends with her acknowledging that she does have feelings for him, they don't kiss.
Right.
He like puts his arm around her, and that's it could be read as a brother sister thing, or it could be read as a romantic thing. Could just be read as an Empire Strikes Back reference, which we get a lot of in this movie. But it works in a way that's like, we're not going to take this, we're not going to go full Casablanca on this. We're going
right.
to pull back a little bit.
And to the movie's credit, you had brought up Spider-Man 2 earlier, and I've talked before about my love of Spider-Man 2, and in particular the last shot in Spider-Man 2, and how for me that makes the whole movie. And I won't say that the last shot of Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2 rivals the last shot of Spider-Man 2, but it's definitely a part of that conversation, and it made me so happy when, we get the big group shot, and most movies would kind of end there, and then we come to a close-up of Rocket with one tear going down his little furry cheek, and I sat there saying, please black out, please black out, please black out, because there's nothing that makes me happier than a movie that knows exactly when to end. And the fact that it did made me so happy that it zeroes in on this little, for lack of a better word, human emotion. I know he's a trash panda, but that it's about that connection and what this character is feeling, that it allows this enormously expensive, massive space opera to end on that small emotional beat reminded me very much of Spider-Man 2 in a really good way.
Yep. And because I don't know how to end things well, I have to, I'm pretty sure it's Trash Bandit.
Oh, it's Trash Bandit?
I think that's what they call raccoons. Although I love Trash Panda.
I seriously thought he said Trash Panda.
That is the greatest band name. If no one,
Trash Bandit makes way more sense, but I thought he said Trash Panda.
Ladies and gentlemen, Trash Panda.
I loved the trash. Okay, so it's Trash Bandit, but I love
doesn't
that,
matter.
Like,
still a funny scene. I think it's very cute.
No, I love the scene where he says, is that worse? And then Drax is like, I don't know. And then it's worse.
So
it's
much
so much
worse.
That, again, it comes at the humor from such a unique off-kilter angle.
Yeah, there. I don't know. Back to the wonderful single tier before I derail this. I think there are actually a few times in the movie where that's used. But I think Drax even has a single tier at some point. That's like, it's like, okay, whatever. It works. It works well.
Sure.
And I love the Ravagers tribute at the end.
It's beautiful. That was another moment that I was wishing was in IMAX because it's so spectacular looking. And I was just happy to see Stallone come back. The fact that James Gunn said, oh, you like Guardians of the Galaxy? Well, the only thing that could make it better is if I add Kurt Russell and Sylvester Stallone.
Absolutely.
If I bring in Tango and Cash.
Exactly.
And boy, he had me.
Yeah. And I mean, and it is a credit again to the movie that the Ravagers tribute, we see, we're basically introduced to the idea that there's a whole, all these Ravager groups out there in one scene at the beginning of the movie. We meet Sylvester Stallone. We know that they hate Yondu. That sets off the whole kind of mutiny thing. But then that's basically it. That's enough to set up this idea that they're outcast Ravagers and there's all these other Ravager things. And then when they come back at the end, I don't know these other groups. I just know, a giant, massive tribute as being awesome to someone that I care about who's, sacrificed. So,
and that the emotional climax of the movie, the movie is about resolving what it is that a lot of these characters want, whether it's, in most cases, as you said, it's a family, and Yondu is just kind of this supporting character from the first movie, essentially a supporting character in this movie, but that the emotional climax of the film is in sort of resolving what he would have wanted. And the fact that it's as affecting as it is again a testament to how invested we are in all of the characters, not just the main Guardians of the Galaxy, and James Gunn's ability to make us care about what each one of them wants. Even Nebula, who was a villain in the last movie, all of a sudden we're like, no, come on, be a nice sister to her.
Right.
And we're happy when they get along and when they kind of team up. There's a moment late in the film where we get the big group shot except now it also has Nebula and Yondu and Mantis.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, I'm so excited. I'm happy to see the team expanding. But then Nebula leaves and Yondu dies. And so it's like, all right, so it's just Mantis?
Well, Nebula will be back, I'm sure.
Yo, for sure, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, even a shot, I mean, back to the idea of, I think, all the kind of different ways that James Gunn approaches family and love and connection in the movie. I mean, that the sequence, you know, the scene right before Stallone, you know, and Yondu have their confrontation. It's, you know, Yondu with the robot prostitute, and he's standing there looking kind of bummed, and she just like shuts herself off. And that's like that's another way that people have connection in this universe, and you can tell that he wants more.
Right.
And I think that like those kind of little things all add up. Which I think helps me to kind of ignore some of the some of the suddenness with the ego transition, was saying like, here's another character who wants or thinks he wants or represents not only Peter's desire for father, but like you know, ego goes out because he's lonely. Like, he goes and seeks out other life forms because he's lonely. He just doesn't understand what connection with other people means. He thinks it's, you know, conquering. He thinks this expansion, you know, he doesn't actually understand that it's, you know, it can be something more profound.
Right. And the moments like that you just brought up, and I'm glad you mentioned it, because I really like that shot of Yondu looking bummed out and the robot shutting down. You know, there's an example of exploring character and theme visually, again, without having to just outright say, man, I wish there was something more than a robot who shut down after sex. So those moments do help take some of the sting out of, for me at least, when the characters do come right out and say stuff. You know, it's not a movie that does only that, because there are a number of really nice, you know, unspoken character beats and things that are left implied or unsaid, to kind of balance out some of the stuff that's more on the nose, you know.
And maybe it's a little unfair that James Gunn built this in, but he has established characters who are very literal and who do say things out loud. I mean, Drax can get away with being on the nose because that's just how he is.
Sure.
I know there are other characters who should be more subtle and aren't in this movie, but I mean, like, that's a way to do it that feels true to the character and also happens to be a little handy for plot and you know, delivering your themes. But I don't know. I really, really enjoyed it. I will, you know, it's the best Marvel movie yet. And the problem is, it might actually be my favorite Marvel movie yet. I don't know. I can't tell.
Well, that's why we don't need to make these declarations the weekend each of these comes out, right? It's like, can we live with these for a little while, please? Right.
I will say, after having just seen Guardians, which I still really, really like, that's a great, great movie. I think this movie, for me, expands on what he did in the first movie, and, you know, is better only, you know, if only because he laid so much good groundwork in the first one.
Sure.
That we can jump right into kind of established relationships in this movie. And I think, you know, we talk about, you know, the problems that could come from splitting the group up. In this case, like, the Rocket Yondu storyline and what brings them ultimately to Ego's planet is interesting and compelling enough to me that I didn't mind that he split up from the rest of the group. And I, you know, so I thought that worked out okay. They had the group fighting, but they didn't reset in the same way that they did in like Into Darkness, which is just like unforgivable. Like, it didn't feel like, oh, we got to get the band back together again.
Right.
It felt more like Empire Strikes Back, in the sense that the groups are kind of split up and then they're going to come out together. And I know that that's not at all accidental.
Right.
I mean, this is going to be totally weird to say. This might actually be the movie that convinces me that Empire Strikes Back is better than Star Wars. I don't know.
Did you not already think that?
I didn't.
All right.
I honestly would say, you know, the original Star Wars is still better than Empire Strikes Back because it's a more complete story.
Sure.
And all this kind of stuff. And now I'm like, oh, you know, I don't know. Maybe having these, you know, more interesting character moments, even though they're all split up, is more compelling storytelling. I don't know. I'm not quite there yet, but I'm closer now, thanks to Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2. And I will say that I think, you know, why this is the best Marvel movie. I think that not only is the young actor CGI better in this movie, but I think it does a slightly better job of using the death of a parent as a motivating factor for a hero than perhaps Civil War does at the end of that movie.
Oh, I would agree with that. That's, you know, a little bit arbitrary in Civil War because we.
I mean, it makes in this one, it's like, you gave my mom cancer,
right?
You're dead. You know, that right. makes sense. I think maybe more so. So,
well, because part of the problem with Civil War is that we've been through three movies with Iron Man,
yeah,
and then in Civil War, it's like, oh, now this is your motivating factor, you know what I mean? Like,
right.
this hasn't come up for three other movies. Why is it suddenly the most important thing?
Now I know that whenever these Marvel podcasts come along, you aren't always thrilled with Marvel's use of Easter eggs, not Easter eggs, but post credits.
Yeah.
How did you feel about them in this case?
Well, here's the thing. I was irritated going in because there was a day where suddenly every movie website was like, Guardians of the Galaxy will have 5 post-credit scenes. Like,
right.
We don't need to keep talking about that. No, I thought this was a great use of them because they were just little extended character beats for the most part. I thought Teenage Groot was funny. The Ravager thing, like, are they setting up a Ravager spinoff? Maybe. I don't know. Whatever. It's fine. I thought all those beats, you know, Drax getting hit with the arrow, like, I thought it was funny how long they have him scream for. Really, the only one that kind of sets something up does what it's supposed to do. One of my issues with the post-credits scenes have always been that they seem to announce the next movie that we already know is coming.
Right.
So it's like, we found Thor's hammer, but we already know that they're making a Thor movie, so why do I care? And in this movie, they suggest that Adam Warlock is coming, and that's news, you know? Like, that's a genuine surprise. And so when they do that, that's really the only one that exists to sort of maybe set something up in the future, and it's a genuine surprise. So I thought all of them worked in the way that they're supposed to work. Yeah.
Apparently, now I recognize the Adam Warlock one. I didn't recognize what was happening with the Sylvester Stallone one, although apparently he's a character named Starhawk, who I'm not super familiar with, and that whole group is an established Marvel, you know. But so I feel like what's cool about, you know, the end credit sequence of this movie in particular is that it's either just like a funny character moment that isn't really tied to anything in particular, or it's something that's really obscure and is for the super fans,
right,
to kind of just latch onto, and it's kind of just a fun, like, ooh, maybe this is going to be something. It's not announcing the next movie. And I want to say it's been a while since they've used it to say this is the next one coming, but I guess they just keep doing it, don't they? Because I can't remember what the post-credit sequence was in Civil War, because it wasn't in the first 20 minutes of the movie, so I'm not quite sure.
I honestly don't remember either.
Was it a Spider-Man thing? It might have been a Spider-Man thing, but I can't remember.
Yeah, you might be right.
Oh, yeah,
he gives him the
spider
light.
Signal
Yeah. Right. Like,
I'm generally a fan of them in the same way that I've gotten used to and can appreciate what these movies are now and how they relate to each other.
Sure.
And that I'm no longer irritated with them is like, why do they continue making these movies? Why do they keep making comic books? Like, this is just what they are. The end credit sequence, it's like, oh, I like seeing little things that are kind of fun and surprising. I mean, and the first Guardians, I think, did it well in that it was that Howard the Duck thing that was just a complete throwaway, although he shows up again in this movie,
which was cool. Fun, right?
It's fun. You know, I mean, they made some nice kind of callbacks to the first movie. Rocket, you know, laughing about the guy waking up without his eyeball is, you know, direct reference to the little leg thing from the first movie. It's, you know, it's little stuff. It's not like the biggest thing in the movie. It's not going to make or break the movie.
Which is good. I don't want a movie that's just filled with, hey, remember that one? You know, like, oh, yeah. I loved the end credits also.
Yep.
I thought they were just so colorful, and seeing the cast dance and a weird Jeff Goldblum reference, which was the closest the movie comes to tying into Thor Ragnarok, you know?
Yeah, I miss that for you know, as much as I like our local theater, like, as soon as the credits start, they turn the house lights on. So like even though those the post credit sequences are like in full
Oh, okay.
light and kind of washed out, and so I didn't, and the credits were
One
the
of
same, which
the
is
dancing characters in the little side
oh.
pictures was Jeff Goldblum's character from Thor Ragnarok.
Oh,
And
cool. That's cool.
again, no attention is called to it. It just goes by. I thought the, you know, having writing a song about Guardians of the Galaxy and having David Hasselhoff sing it was a nice
Yeah,
little
that was great.
payoff of that whole thing. Right. It's just, it's super fun and it sends you out of the theater like I had a great time. And for as much as I have pointed to some things and I'm like, ah, this didn't totally work for me, obviously I'm able to overlook all of it because it is really fun. And it, we had opened the show by saying, you know, that we rarely rewatch these Marvel movies. I feel like Guardians 1 and 2 are the ones, at least right now, that I want to revisit the most often because I like the world, because I like the characters, because I like the humor, because I like everything that James Gunn brings to it, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I it really, and also going back to the beginning of the show, like the reason that I'm not super excited or haven't been so far about the DC universe is that the movies themselves aren't great.
Right. I don't want
And
to
you know,
spend
and
time in this world.
right, I mean,
Right.
but if you know, if a James Gunn's caliber director made a DC movie, you know, I mean, James Wan's Aquaman has me excited. Like I like what he does. Let's see what he does with Aquaman. That sounds fine. Like the same way that like Edgar Wright making Ant-Man, even though it never happened, like that was never a problem for me. Like I don't care if it's a character I don't know. It's a great director. I don't care if
Right.
James Gunn is making a movie about these comic book characters I've never heard of before 2014. Sign me up, you
Right,
know.
right.
So
And we've gone for over an hour, and we haven't even talked about a bunch of stuff. And obviously, we're pretty much out of time. But like the Sovereign,
oh yeah.
I liked. I mean, obviously, they exist to kind of set the plot into motion. But I love the way that like they don't pilot their own ships; they do
Yeah,
it
that was great.
remotely. I love the video game sound effects. I mean, it's like you dislike them as the rich kids right away, you know, and the movie doesn't do a ton to set them up that way, but you just automatically feel that way towards them. And I thought that was such a nice touch.
Yeah, it was great. And that the one, you know, and then it kind of it boils down to the one guy who's like getting the high score on the you know
Right,
on the Guardians
right.
of the Galaxy machine, and he gets shot out
And they're all just
by Drax.
annoyed
Like, oh,
with,
you suck.
right, they're
It's
all.
just like that's such a great touch. Yeah, the Sovereign or they you know all gold, pretty
Right.
cool. Oh
And
yeah.
plus, Ben Browder from Farscape shows up as one of them. And I was like, oh, that's a fun little Farscape reference, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I you know the as much as I've kind of grown tired of Stan Lee being in these movies, it's cool to see the Watchers.
It was cool to see the Watchers, and I liked that his cameo existed to say, to make reference to all the other cameos, you know?
Were there now? I as far as like Easter eggs go, and I'm sure there are going to be about a billion stories written about this in the next few days. But I. Is there anything else you saw like during the scene where they were jumping around between like warping around trying to get to Ego's planet with a kind of those, yeah, I liked the Roger Rabbit effects on the on everyone's face. But did you recognize anything else in any of the places that they jumped between
Not that I
besides the Watchers?
remember, but that does seem like one of the areas where they would sneak in Easter eggs.
I'll have to read the latest on some
Yeah,
other.
right. I'm
Some
sure
other movie news
on
site.
every movie site. I was
The
excited,
top
super
rating
excited
shows.
to see Yondu get his big mohawk too, and
Oh yeah,
then
it's
that
great.
maybe that I think that was the thing that I was saddest about when he died. I was like, no,
Oh yeah.
Yondu finally looks super
Yeah.
cool. I mean, I've liked Yondu in both
I love
movies.
the shot of Yondu and Rocket like slow walking to the escape pod with bodies just raining from the ceiling.
Yes. And
That was great.
Yondu's Mary Poppins moment might be the
That
best
was
moment in the
great. That
movie.
was great.
Yeah. So the
I'm Mary
movie's filled
Poppins,
with,
y'all.
yeah,
That was so
right.
good.
It's filled with cool stuff like that. And despite what I've said about having some issues with some of the plotting, I
These
thought
are
the movie
there
was.
are all of your issues totally like you're not wrong. I think that these are the kind of issues that won't necessarily make or break a movie, but if you watch a movie, any movie, and you are generally on board with it, you can be like me. Be like, ah, it's fine. I didn't care.
But I feel like this was your position on Amazing Spider-Man.
It was, you know, I haven't gone back and watched and
This is a
rewatched it.
way better movie than Amazing
This is a way
Spider-Man.
better movie than. And look, just because I say, oh, it was, I mean, Spider-Man, Amazing Spider-Man, I think I probably said, oh, it was fine. Guardians Volume 2, I'm saying, this is a really good movie. I like it a lot.
Yeah.
It's not, I'm not saying, now I'm just saying that some of the things you had problems with, I didn't have as big problems with. Sure. I recognize it could be better, but I'm not going to complain about it. This is a way better movie than Amazing Spider-Man, which I have not gone back and rewatched.
Neither have I.
I'm not going to pretend that I didn't leave the theater after watching Amazing Spider-Man thinking to myself, this was the Batman Begins of the Spider-Man franchise. I don't know what's wrong with me.
Did you see Amazing Spider-Man 2?
I did not see Amazing Spider-Man 2. I will probably never see Amazing Spider-Man 2.
It is atrocious.
This is why.
There's a reason they ended that franchise.
Right. Right. So, which is why I love Spider-Man. I think we both love Spider-Man. So I'm very hopeful for Spider-Man Homecoming. I don't know if Vulture is going to do it for me or not, but I like Spider-Man. So
this Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2 getting summer off, I think, to a very good start. You know, I feel like it can only go downhill from here, which isn't to say that all the movies this summer will be bad. There are movies that I'm very excited about, but it'll be hard to make a movie as entertaining as this one was consistently all the way through, and as entertaining in a way that's like really fun.
We've got Baby Driver out in less than 2 months.
Good point.
To me, it's like if Guardians Volume 2 and Baby Driver, and that's really all I need for the summer. I can't even think of what else is out this summer.
I'm excited about Planet of the Apes.
Oh, yeah. I like those movies.
Yeah, they've been good.
I like the last one. I will go see the next one.
Yeah.
Despite my better instincts, I like the summer. I'm always excited for summer movies. I'm usually disappointed, but I do like summer movies.
I think I'm the same way. And it's only in recent years where I feel like I feel more burned out on them. But I think that's the result of maybe a rough summer or two.
Sure.
I think last summer might have been rough. I can't even remember what came out. But
last summer, was that Terminator Genesis and those kind of movies?
I think that was 2 years ago. I don't even remember what last summer was. But
no, last summer was Jurassic World, was it?
No, that was 2 years ago also. Yeah, last summer was Suicide Squad, and I don't know.
Oh, yeah,
else,
it was. And Batman versus Superman.
Yeah.
Oh, no, that was March.
That was, yeah, March.
I don't know. Oh, I mean, there was Civil War last year.
Was that last year?
Yeah,
I've already forgotten.
I know. I don't know. All I know is that we're getting a new Edgar Wright movie. I don't care about.
I'm very excited for that.
I don't care about the Pirates of Caribbeans. I don't care. I've never seen the Transformers movie.
You're doing all right.
That's the thing. I'm saving. I'm saving myself for Edgar Wright.
Good. You're doing the right thing. Anyway, thank you for coming on to talk about this movie. It's always fun to talk movies with you. And thank you all for listening. As always, you can find our website at fthismovie.net. Follow us on Facebook or on Twitter. We're at fthismovie. We're on, you know, YouTube, Instagram, all of the social media platforms. You can email us at fthismoviepodcast@gmail.com. Next week, we will be back, I believe, that JB and I will be doing our annual year so far podcast, where we kind of take stock of the movies released in 2017 up to this point.
Yay.
So make sure you tune in for that. And thanks again, Eric. This was awesome.
Thanks. I had a lot of fun.
Bye, everybody.
Thanks for listening to FS Movie.